Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, publishers of Virginia Woolf's long-neglected novel, Night and Day, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, available in stores and at bn.com. And from Jeep, introducing the trail-rated Jeep Liberty CRD with next-generation diesel technology, emissions and performance capabilities at jeep.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The novelist and Nobel Prize winner Saul Bellow died Tuesday at the age of 89. In his New York Times obituary, Mel Gussow and Charles Magora described Bellow as the self-proclaimed historian of society whose fictional heroes and whose scathing, unrelenting, and darkly comic examination of their struggle for meaning gave new immediacy to the American novel in the second half of the 20th century. Bellow's best-known novels include The Adventures of Augie March, Henderson the Rain King, Herzog, and Humboldt's Gift. In addition to the Nobel, Herzog won 3 Pulitzer Prizes, 3 National Book Awards, and a Presidential Medal. He's regarded as a great American writer, but he grew up in Quebec to Jewish immigrant parents from Russia. I spoke with him in 1989 after the publication of his novella, The Bella Rosa Connection. The narrator, who heads an institute for memory technique in Philadelphia, tells the story of his late friend, a Jewish immigrant who was saved from the Holocaust in an escape operation overseen by the Broadway producer Billy Rose. I asked Saul Bellow to read the opening of the book.
As founder of the Mnemosyne Institute in Philadelphia, 40 years in the trade, I trained many executives, politicians, and members of the defense establishment. And now that I am retired, with the Institute in the capable hands of my son, I would like to forget about remembering, which is an Alice in Wonderland proposition. In your twilight years, having hung up your gloves or sheathed your knife, you don't want to keep doing what you did throughout your life. A change, your kingdom for a change. A lawyer will walk away from his clients, a doctor from his patients. A general will paint China, a diplomatist turn to fly fishing. My case is different in that I owe my worldly success to the innate gift of memory. A tricky word, innate, referring to the hidden sources of everything that really matters. As I used to say to clients, memory is life. That was a neat way to impress a member of the National Security Council whom I was coaching. But it puts me now in an uncomfortable position, because if you have worked in memory, which is life itself, there is no retirement except in death.
So Bellow, as this character tells us in the first paragraph, he wants to forget about remembering. Has this been a period where memory has been especially persistent or troubling to you?
Well, I seem to be one of these curious cases of a person whose memory is continuous. Nietzsche wrote an essay on history in which he says some rather curious things about remembering. He says a strong man can forget those things that will injure him. And I suppose that that's true, so that the power of forgetting should be paired with the power of memory, because the capacity to forget is will preserve your life in some instances. On the other hand, there is no continuity in human life without memory. It's one of the things that distinguishes us from the animals. Not all of us want to be distinguished, but if you insist on distinguishing, making such a distinction, this is one of the main points to bear in mind.
I want to quote something that you wrote in 1987. This was in an essay in the New York Times Book Review. And you wrote, as a Middle Westerner, the son of immigrant parents, I recognized at an early age that I was called upon to decide for myself to what extent my Jewish origins, my surroundings, my schooling were to be allowed to determine the course of my life. When you were young and realizing that you had these choices to make, what did you see as your options when you were thinking how much your background was going to determine what your future was going to be?
Well, I think that at a very early age, I think before puberty, I'd already decided that I wanted to be a writer, and this really, in a way, drew me apart from my family.
Your father had been a businessman.
Well, my father had been the usual rabbinical student who came to America and found nothing better to do than business. And he didn't do it too well. He was not rigidly orthodox. I was not imposed on that way. I just wanted to go my own way. And I did.
You also said that you think you might have become a rabbi if the great world, the world of the streets, had not been so seductive. What was seductive? What did you see? And what do you mean by the world of the streets? What exactly were you exposed to?
I mean Chicago in the 20s. I mean the streets, street life, pool rooms, sports, a modicum of criminal activity, which was inescapable in Chicago during the 20s, the bang-bang time of Prohibition and so on. Just the sense that you were participating in the life of this immense and expanding civilization, which was so fascinating that it drew me away from my Jewishness, not so as to make me forget it, but that I wanted to combine it with other things. I mean, I was deeply unwilling to follow anybody's blueprint from either side of the equation.
I've got to ask, you mentioned something about criminal activity. Were you involved in petty crimes yourself?
Well, every kid is involved in petty crimes, always a certain amount of theft and shoplifting and criminal intentions, which are much more powerful than the crimes you commit when you're a kid.
Were you ever caught for anything?
No, I wasn't, no. I was never interested in shoplifting at Woolworths and things like that people used to get caught at. But if I were working in a department store, as I once did, say at a barrel of surprise packages for Christmas, for a quarter apiece, my buddy and I, who were dressed as Santa Claus's helpers, would pocket an occasional quarter. Never got caught.
Mm-hmm.
But I never went in for big-time dishonesty.
Right. So when you were growing up, did you read a lot, too?
Yes, I did.
Did that let you in on other worlds outside Chicago?
Oh, immensely. That was really terrific. Of course, the first book I read was... the first books I read were the opening books of the Old Testament, which I read in Hebrew and translated into Yiddish, which made an enduring impression on me.
Pretty ambitious for starting out, huh?
Well, I think this is the way Jewish kids started out in traditional Orthodox families.
Did your mother want you to be a rabbi?
Oh, definitely, like my grandfather, her father.
And what were your parents' reaction when they figured out that what you wanted to do was right?
Well, my father thought it was a brainstorm. My mother died when I was only 17, so she didn't live to see the worst. But my father was as dismayed at all this and thought it was improvident and so on and so on. I thought he was improvident, watching him run his business.
What kind of business was it?
He was had a coal yard and supplied apartment houses with coal.
Did that seem very boring to you, like the last life in the world you'd
want
to have?
No, it was very. It was not boring at all. It was very exciting. I often worked in the yard, not shoveling coal, but at the scale. So I knew the life at an early age.
You changed your name when you started writing from Solomon Bellows to Saul Bellow, and I was wondering why you changed your name and why you chose the change that you did.
Well, I didn't. I had been known under both names in the family from the beginning, and I had a choice open to me, and I simply decided that that Saul would be better than Solomon because of the little verse, Solomon Grundy, born on Monday, etc., etc. And it was just, besides, I wanted to break with everybody, my own family too. So I chose the other name, which was a legitimate name and belonged to me.
Chicago is the setting of much of your fiction, but you lived in New York from the 40s through the 60s. And you say that you returned to Chicago when writers became more political in New York. And I was wondering what kind of political expression you wanted to get away from when you left New York.
Oh, well, I just didn't care much for the carrying on about the Vietnam War and so on. I mean, I took my own stand on these matters. I didn't care to be associated with a whole gang of other people.
And did it accomplish what you wanted to move to Chicago in terms of getting away from a group?
Well, I had belonged to a group in New York. I belonged to the old Partisan Review group.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't impose anything on you, and they didn't try to school you in any attitude. They didn't prescribe for you politically. You could think anything you liked. The new outfit wanted to prescribe for you.
Who were you thinking of in the new outfit?
Oh, the mailers and the people like that. People around him. Oh, well, there were several literary establishments that sprang up about that time. There was a New York Review of Books literary establishment. There was the Mailerite establishment. There was the Columbia University establishment, headed by Lionel Trilling and Jacques Barzin, I suppose. I just didn't want to belong to any of these outfits. I had nothing in common with them particularly.
Mm-hmm. In your book, Humboldt's Gift, you referred to, quote, the fastidious goy critics on guard for the Protestant establishment and the genteel tradition. Now, you were really one of the first of the modern Jewish novelists to really make it and reach a wide audience in America. Did you ever feel when you were starting out that you were up against a non-Jewish establishment who might keep you out?
Well, it always helps a young writer to be a belligerent. Militancy is what he chugs along on. So you have to discount. You have to enter a discount for some of this.
Uh-huh.
It's true that we had the experience of first of being locked out, and then of being admitted partly as under the aspect of curiosity. You know. I mean, as Samuel Johnson said about lady poets, they're like dogs that walk on their hind legs. The miracle, what is interesting is not that they do it badly, but that they can do it at all. And I think that this was the category I felt myself being thrust in, and I didn't really like it very much.
What gave you that feeling?
I was battlesome. Well, you know, we had no sooner arrived and begun publishing books, people like Malamud and I, and later on Roth, than we were tagged as Jewish writers. Nobody wants to be tagged in that way. I mean, we thought of ourselves as belonging to the mainstream. We were Americans of Jewish origin. That didn't mean that we had to be tagged that way. And I, for one, really didn't like it. And I jokingly named Roth, Malamud, and myself as the Hartshaffner and Marx of American literature. But that's stuck, rather. I mean, the idea that you were not a full partner in this enterprise.
Saul Bellow, recorded in 1989. He died Tuesday at the age of 89.